Well, dear. Jamie, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, after the October 7 Hamas attack, said that while he condemned the killings, quote, they did not happen in a vacuum, close quote. One of your contributors wrote that the, and I quote, the 2023 massacre of Israeli civilians and the incipient genocide in Gaza would never have happened. Indeed, the Israeli-Palestine conflict would almost certainly have been resolved decades ago, but for Israel, and I'm quoting again, actively spurning and sabotaging prospects for a just resolution to the Palestine question, close quote. In a nutshell, what has been that history in terms of Israel's rejectionist policies?
Well, basically, the entire international community since about the mid-1970s on has agreed on how to resolve the conflict. You basically set up a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza with East Jerusalem as its capital. Israel withdraws to its pre-June 1967 borders, and it reaches a peace agreement on that basis with the Palestinians and with its neighbors. Now, as far back as 1981, the full breadth of the U.S. national intelligence community, as Coulter shows in his really meticulously documented chapter, the full breadth of the U.S. national intelligence community agreed in 1981 on 2 points. First, the Palestinian leadership was willing to coexist with Israel in peace through a two-state solution on the terms of that international consensus. Second, that Israeli rejectionism of that international consensus was the primary obstacle to achieving a peace agreement. Now, the Oslo Accords, which you mentioned, of the 1990s, two agreements, 1993 and 1995, they've often been understood and presented as a break with that long history of Israeli rejectionism, as if they were a kind of well-intentioned, good faith peace process that, for various reasons, failed. Now, that's totally wrong. That's a misunderstanding of what the Oslo Accords were. They weren't a peace process. They were an Israeli annexation process. And so far from failing, they were a tremendous success. The terms of the accords themselves, they never actually prohibited Israel from building illegal settlements in the Palestinian territory that Israel occupied. And also, they never committed Israel to recognizing that Palestinians have a right to a state. So therefore, it's not surprising that in practice, the number of illegal Israeli settlers in occupied Palestinian territory, they nearly doubled in the decade after the first Oslo Agreement was signed. 2000s and 2010s, there were a series of high-level summits in which Palestinian and Israeli negotiators met, usually mediated by the U.S., to reach a deal. I can't now go into all the kind of granular details of them, but the bottom line is Palestinian negotiators consistently were willing to compromise well beyond what they were required to under the terms of that international consensus in order to reach an agreement. The reason those summits failed is because Israel refused to agree to a two-state settlement based on international law.
Jamie Sternwiener, let's talk about the future. The day after the war finally ends, what are Israel's plans for the people of Gaza?
Well, Israel's objectives in Gaza are the subject of a chapter in the book by Yaniv Kogan, who's a really brilliant Israeli researcher. He copiously documents that the basic policy Israel's pursued in Gaza since October 7th, spelled out by Israeli officials and then put clearly into practice, has been to make the territory permanently uninhabitable. That's why they've systematically targeted hospitals. That's why they destroyed 60% of homes and so on. And they have, it has to be said, to a shocking extent, already succeeded. Journalists who managed to gain access to parts of Gaza, especially the north, they describe it as a moonscape. It's going to be years before the northern part of Gaza becomes inhabitable again, if then. Now, after making Gaza uninhabitable, what then? What is Israel's plan for those 2 million people who are trapped there? Here it seems like various ideas have emerged. And it should be said that there's a difference between this round in Gaza and previous ones, or most previous ones. In most previous Gaza wars, Israel initiated them, meaning it went in with a clear plan in mind. This time, of course, it was Hamas that instigated the immediate crisis. And so Israel's response has actually been, to a greater extent than usual, worked out on the fly. And I think it's been characterized by more by tactical and strategic incoherence than the working through of a, you know, calculated plan. But several options have emerged. So at the most extreme end, there are currents in Israel that just want to exterminate the population, to slaughter Amalek, the biblical enemy of the Jews. At the other pole, it seems clear that at least at the outset, in the first few weeks of its offensive, Israel wanted to expel the population of Gaza into the Sinai Desert. And the U.S. was actually on board with that idea. Secretary of State Antony Blinken traveled to the region and tried to sell it to Egypt, Jordan, but the Egyptian dictator Sisi refused, and the border remains for now closed. So we're currently in a situation where ethnic cleansing looks to be off the table, at least until Egypt, unless Egypt is brought to change its mind. And if we assume that international pressure will preclude an outright extermination, it's actually not clear at the moment what Israel's endgame in Gaza is. All kinds of ideas have been floated, and they're analyzed in the book by Nathan Brown of the Carnegie Institute and Muin Rabbani, the leading Palestinian political analyst. But currently, all the ideas that have been floated really have very little connection to reality.
Jamie, you write in your marvelous book, again, A Deluge, Gaza and the Israeli, From Crisis to Cataclysm. You write that in, and I quote, "In 2023, Gaza became a symbol for injustice, inequality, and the hypocrisies of power writ large. And around this symbol, the glimmer of a new international order could be inspired. Please elaborate."
Well, it's just been really stunning and inspiring to see this wave of international solidarity for Gaza, including in those societies like the U.S., which are Israel's strongest allies, and where, you know, historically there's been a lot of support publicly for Israel as well. We've seen mass demonstrations, not just once or twice, but week after week, over 6 months. It should be noted that progressive Jews, many of them young, have been in the militant vanguard of these demonstrations. And this is all just unprecedented. And what's especially moving, at least to me, is all being done on behalf of the people of Gaza, that tiny enclave half a world away in the Middle East. So why has that plight, why has the plight of Gaza so resonated? Well, I, you know, there are many reasons, of course, but I think that one is that in this harsh world governed by brute power politics, Gaza has no material leverage whatsoever. You know, it has no oil. It has no real military. It's this impoverished camp with no resources or political weight, whose people are, just because they are powerless, being brutalized with impunity. And so Gaza has become, I think, a kind of purely moral symbol of the broader injustices of power that we're all, and especially younger generations, of course to a lesser extent than the people in Gaza, suffering from. So if the people of Gaza have no future because of that illegal Israeli blockade, well, isn't that true in a sense of all of us in this age of economic stagnation and looming World War III? And if the people of Gaza are being tormented by an unaccountable power and reduced to poverty by these unaccountable elites, again, in a sense, isn't that true for many of us, especially young people, in this age of oligarchy and yawning economic inequality? So I think it's for those reasons that the plight of Gaza resonates now across the world.